This week's podcast is made possible through the contributions of listeners like you. Please consider giving a gift to keep this podcast running along with other From the Top programming. Go to fromthetop.org.
It's NPR's From the Top, the showcase for the best young classical musicians in the country, celebrating 10 years on the air. Today, from the Schwartz Center for Performing Arts at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, our lineup of outstanding performers includes a 13-year-old pianist from Tennessee performing Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody No. 6, and a 15-year-old bassist from nearby Marietta who plays his unwieldy instrument like it's a violin. From the Top's home is New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall in Boston. Here's our host, one of America's great concert pianists, Christopher O'Reilly.
Thank you. Thanks very much, everybody. And welcome to the program. As regular listeners to our program know, kids from Atlanta are such good musicians that we fly them all over the country to do shows with us, you know, to show kids in places like Boston and New York City how music should really be played. Every once in a while, we've got to come back to the source to catch up with a new crop of young players who are the products of the exceptional training available here in Atlanta. And I want to thank Emory University for making that happen once again and welcoming us back to this beautiful concert hall. It's such a pleasure to be here with you. So, not surprisingly, today's show is chock full of local musicians, including the 99 members of the Emory Youth Symphony Orchestra who will play the music of William Walton later on. And this duo up first, please welcome from here in Atlanta, 15-year-old flutist Hallie Davidson and 16-year-old pianist Brian Anderson. Hallie, I've introduced you by name, but you actually have a name for your duo, your ensemble.
We do. We call our ensemble Music to Share. That's T-W-O.
Oh, very
Share.
Good. T-W-O, and you've brought some music to share?
Yes, we have. We're going to be playing the Finale from Suite for Flute and Piano by Charles-Marie Vidor.
Charles-Marie Vidor is, of course, best known for his colossal pieces for the organ, so it's very nice to hear his more intimate chamber music side. When you two are ready, we can take it from the top. Brian, I'm going to come turn pages for you.
Thank you.
from Charles Louis Vidor's Suite for Flute and Piano, played for us by Hallie Davidson, 15-year-old flutist, and Brian Anderson, 16-year-old pianist. They're both from here in Atlanta. I think it's just amazing. You kids really, it feels like such a beautiful melding of styles. You've been playing together forever, it feels like, and that's actually true. Of all the friends we've met who are in duos or chamber ensembles, I think you've known each other the longest. When did you actually meet?
Oh,
we don't remember.
It was
so long ago.
Been a long time.
So, pre-verbal skills, I guess.
Not really.
Close, but not quite.
Or did you know? Were you even playing an instrument before they put you in a room together and told you to rehearse the Vidor or something? Or
No, I think we were just
in preschool,
friends.
Pretty much.
Okay,
so
preschool.
It was pretty easy
we could
for
talk.
Our parents.
So maybe 3 years old. It pays off. Well, in honor of your seasoned friendship, I want to talk about things that you share. Things that bring you together, but I'm going to raise these topics in unusual ways. Here goes. Maigovanen meldisnin ellen sila lomen omen tielvo.
Na sila, reindeer odiofelen a melenham fanwie, totham lesian lambeth iruth a mordor.
Easy for you to say. Of course, I know what I said, but I have no idea what you said. Translate, why don't you, and tell everybody what's going on.
You said, well met, my friend. A star shines upon the hour of our meeting. And I said, indeed it shines. But strangers of distant lands and friends of old, we have all been summoned here tonight to answer the threat of Mordor.
They don't look terribly threatening. I see a couple of orcs in the back room. But so Mordor should give us the hint that we're speaking what?
Speaking Elvish.
Elvish.
Language of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings world.
So you guys are Tolkien fanatics?
Yes.
Oh, sure.
All the way.
read all the books?
Mm-hmm. I don't... There are a whole lot of them. I can't say I've read all of them.
There's about 32 books.
I mean, wasn't I reading that you were telling me that there's an awful lot of Tolkien that he didn't finish?
He hardly ever finished anything.
Really? So we should be very thankful for the Lord of the Rings cycle.
Yes.
And it was his publisher's fault he finished it.
Oh, good. Okay, well, good for them.
This is the only reason.
So, and Brian, I guess... Hallie's more the language buff as far as Elvish, and you're really good in the Tolkien trivia department.
Yes, that's true.
So give us an obscure Tolkien trivia question that'll stump our highly educated listeners.
All right, then. What was Morgoth's fortress before Angband?
Well,
if you know.
I mean, who doesn't know that? I mean, you're being very kind. Okay, listen up, people. The first three listeners to answer that question at our website... FromTheTop.org, get our latest CD as a prize. Okay? So they're all turning their phones on as they start texting. Okay. Next thing you two share. Brian, this is a question for you. Eine Frage für ihn. Warum ist Deutsch die größte Sprache in der ganzen Welt?
Man kann Amerikaner auf Deutsch beleidigen und sie haben keine Ahnung.
Ich lächelt. My sixth grade German leads me to believe that I sort of pronounced, why is German the greatest language in the world? And your response, of course?
You can insult Americans and they don't know. They don't have a clue.
So you like speaking German together, both of you?
Definitely.
So what happens? I mean, are there any special occasions where German comes in handy?
Rehearsal.
Yeah? How come?
Bad rehearsals.
Yeah?
Yes, just insults and whatever we can think of.
Everything sounds insulting in German, doesn't it?
Well, of course.
Gemütlich is a sort of a nice feeling, yeah. But it sounds like a
swear word.
Swear word, yes. Go ahead. I'm glad you said it, not me. Great having you
Thank
on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Best of luck to both of you. Music to share. Touché. Brian Anderson, 16 years old, and Hallie Davidson, 15, from here in Atlanta.
Remember to answer Brian's trivia question about Tolkien, and if you're fast, get our latest CD, go to our website, FromTheTop.org. Also, while you're there, check out the ways we're celebrating our 10th anniversary season. From the Top is made possible in part by the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, advancing the education of students of exceptional promise who have financial need. On the web at jkcf.org. Chris.
Thanks, Joanne. Our next performer, pianist Ming Wilson, drove to be with us from Johnson City, Tennessee. He's one of our Jack Kent Cook young artists, and although you'd never guess it, he's only 13 years old. Ming, tell us why our radio listeners might not guess you are 13 years old.
Because with shoes on, I am 6'1".
Exactly. And there's something else that's not very 13 of you, your ability at the piano. What are you going to play for us?
I will be playing the Hungarian Rhapsody No. 6 by Franz Liszt.
I was wondering, Ming, are you conscious of the audience as you play, or do you just sink into the music?
I think it's both. You know, when I'm playing, I think I'm always aware that there's people watching me, but I do try to focus on the music.
Reason I ask is we have a very special guest with us in the audience who was very aware of her audience when she started playing concerts at the age of 6, just a little bit younger than you. We're going to meet her now because she has a dedication to make for the Liszt you're about to play. Her remarkable story is one of survival through music. Born in the Ukraine, she was offered a scholarship to the Moscow State Conservatory, but her life dramatically changed in 1941 when the Nazis grouped her Jewish family with thousands to be executed at Drobitsky Yar. Her father bribed a soldier with a gold watch, and she was able to escape. Along with her younger sister, she made up a non-Jewish identity and played piano for various shows for the occupying Nazi troops. Adopted by American refugee camp administrator after the war, she and her sister became two of the first Jewish refugees to enter the Juilliard School. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a woman who was a legendary member of the faculty at Indiana University for many years and now lives here in Atlanta, Zhanna Arshenskaya. Zhanna, it's a great privilege to have you in our audience. If people want to read more about your story, your son, Greg Dawson, just published a fantastic book about you. Tell everyone what it's called.
It's called Hiding in a Spotlight.
And I'm happy to report that last time I checked, anyway, on Amazon, if you go to musical biographies, it's number 2, right behind Michael Jackson's biography, actually. Zhanna, as one of our great teachers, how many students do you think you have had over the years here in America? How many do you think?
All together in America. Well, I would certainly think up to 100.
Ming, who's your teacher?
My teacher is Dr. Donald Conflenti.
So, and this must give you a whole different idea of being conscious of your audience when you play, or perhaps even going so far as to play as if your life depends on it.
Sure.
Why don't you get settled over here at the piano? I understand, Zhanna, while Ming is being poised at the piano, you have a dedication you'd like to make for this Liszt.
Oh, definitely. And I would like to dedicate it, only it's a surprise. I'm dedicating it to Christopher O'Reilly, the ambassador of music of young people of America.
Very kind of you. Ming Wilson, 13 years old, a pianist from Johnson City, Tennessee, playing the great Hungarian Rhapsody No. 6 of Franz Liszt. A towering performance, not just because you're 6'1". Man, that was phenomenal.
Thanks.
Really great. It just sounds so great in this room, too. Just beautifully done. Thank you, Ming. Incredible job. Well prepared, but I guess nothing could prepare you for moving to America and into an American school.
Mm-hmm.
You were born where and went to school?
I was born in Xi'an, China, and when I was 5.5 years old, I moved to Chengdu, China, and that's where I attended elementary school.
And you moved to the United States at what age?
At 7.
So you were in China until then, and in your class, you were...
Mm-hmm. I was the appointed class leader.
So what do you do as class leader? Is this you were appointed or you were elected? Or?
Well, the teacher is the one who appoints them, mm-hmm. and it's kind of like row by row. And your job was to check homework or to discipline the kids if they act up.
Nice way to make friends, yeah. I guess, in class, huh? Check their homework?
Yep.
You must have been a really popular guy.
Were they appointed leaders.
Yeah, exactly. Were you 5'10 at that point? Was that why you were, you know...
No,
you were,
I was kind of normal then.
You were sort of normal, so, and they just gave you this job, and... I mean, did that make you feel good? Did it give you a sense of purpose, or was it really a drag with your friends?
You know, even though I was appointed class leader, I mean, I think we still got along okay.
It was good. It was a position of respect.
Yeah, it was a good position.
So take us through then your first experience in an American classroom.
Okay. After I got here, and I really didn't know very well English, but like a few weeks later, the teacher, she was asked by another teacher to walk out to the room. And then the other kids started acting up and they were talking and stuff. And it really wasn't that bad, but, you know, I didn't really even have anybody to talk to. But as they were acting up, you know, I just thought, well, maybe I'll do something nice for the teacher. And I closed my eyes and I covered my ears and I just shouted at the top of my lungs. I was like, everybody be quiet.
And so did your teacher appreciate this disciplinary?
Maybe at heart, but she came in there and kind of gave me a stern conversation, telling me never to do it again.
And the kids in class, I'm sure, really appreciated it, too.
Yeah, they still remember it.
Still remember it. That's great. I'm amazed, though, to hear that story and then your experience in the States, your experience back in China. You now have gone back and visited China.
Mm-hmm.
What's your impression now? The educational system there and here?
Well, last summer I went back and hung out with some of my old classmates. And, you know, as I was hanging out with him, I just felt really blessed and fortunate that I got to come here and study at American School, because here they promote creativity, mm-hmm. and you have a lot of free time, for instance, to practice the piano or pursue whatever you want. Mm-hmm. But over there, the kids, they have to be very competitive and they have to work very, very hard to, you know, to get a job in life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they get off school at 5 and then they eat and then they go back and tutor more.
So, in the evening?
Yeah. And then they have vacation and summer homework.
So there's
weekend
homework. It's weekend homework, vacation homework, all of this.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it sounds like very, very hard work. Mm-hmm. And you feel it's a little bit more freewheeling in the States. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit more leeway.
Right.
But is there anything that bugs you about American kids in your school?
Sometimes, you know, I'm kind of surprised by what my fellow classmates hold as important to them. You know, some of them, they think that, you know, such as clothes or TV shows, you know, stuff like that, it's more important than studying.
Yeah.
And some of my friends might disagree with that, but then, you know, my mom tells me I'm too mature for my age, so.
Well, you're certainly too tall for your age, but I'm willing to put you at the head of the class as class leader in hopes that you'll whip us into shape, and we wish you the best of luck with piano playing and everything you do. Great hearing you play, man. Thank you. Thanks very much. Ming Wilson, 13 years old, from Johnson City, Tennessee. Now we're going to hear a wonderful piece for the double bass performed by 15-year-old Xavier Foley, our third local performer of this show. Xavier, where exactly in the great Peachtree State are you from?
I'm from Marietta, Georgia.
That's about how far away? Yeah, Marietta?
Yeah.
You and I are going to play the great music of Giovanni Bottesini. Tell everybody about him. He was a composer and a bass player, or tell us about him.
Yeah, he was also a conductor. He conducted many symphonies like Aida, and between intermissions, he would play his little solos like what I'm about to play, which is the Bottesini Second Concerto First Movement.
Well, I think that would improve operatic life quite a bit, playing a double bass concerto in the midst of that. It is also a beautifully lyrical piece, especially in your hands. Well, let's do this.
All right.
Thank you.
Xavier Foley, 15 years old, playing the first movement of Giovanni Bottesini's Concerto for Double Bass.
Wow, you really make that instrument sing, man. It's just beautiful. It's just great. You know, I want to talk about, you know, the fact that, I mean, the bass bow, I mean, just getting a sound out of this instrument with a bow that's closer to a baseball bat than a violin bow, but it's amazing to me. Do you ever run out of bow? I mean, there's some of these virtuoso passages in this Bottesini where it just seems like, I mean, that bow should be, you know, 3 feet longer in order to get all those notes in there. Do you ever worry about running out of bow? Or?
Most certainly, yes.
So show us one of these passages, you know, where, you know, we're trying to get a lot of you know, like a big virtuoso scale in one bow. So if you were trying to do that scale, let's say, you know, if you were trying to be economical with the bow and you say, okay, let's just give it up. I'm going to do this in two bows. What would that sound like? Ugh. Yeah, it would be like an opera singer taking a breath in the middle of a high note or something. So, you know, but what about if you're trying to conserve bow and not use so much? What would that sound like? Yeah, so it sort of strangles the sound. So it's just got to be this happy medium, you know, it's kind of to give it the flair and the edge. Do it again, because it just sounds great when you do it. It's so light, you know. It's amazing to me because, as I say, you know, it's just there's so much. Is it a combination of bounce and pressure? And it's fantastic hearing that and seeing it. It's easy to tell how much you love the double bass. It seems like you were born to it. Did you start out on another instrument and come to the bass, or did you fall in love with it right away?
Well, first when I was 8, I started on piano, and it didn't work out so well because I'm not good at playing two hands at once.
I think you do pretty well with two hands, you know, one hand in a bow and one hand on a fingerboard. That's working out pretty well.
Yeah.
So, and did you have an exercise book, and you know, how long did it take you to get through the fundamentals, would you say?
It was the essential elements, and it took me only a month.
I used
to play it all at home.
So it was pretty much love at first sight, and you just took to it. And this instrument, this particular instrument, is something to fall in love with, too. This is a beautiful carving of, looks like a mermaid almost, playing a violin there. Who made this bass?
His name was Ramon Solano.
And he's a
bass maker, yeah. And this is actually a copy of Edgar Meyer's bass.
Oh.
Except with a flat back instead of a round back.
Edgar's bass has a round back, and so what's the difference? Is there a difference in sound or the technique involved?
It's more of a darker sound with the round back, yeah.
So Edgar's a good bass player, I think.
Oh, yeah.
We like him. We like you just as much, Xavier.
Oh, nice.
We wish you all the best. I mean, it's just amazing, the not just the facility, but the singing tone that you get out of the bass. It's a fantastic, great experience playing with you.
Thanks.
And wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Xavier Foley, 15 years old, from Marietta, Georgia.
Right now on our website, catch up with our next performer, 10th anniversary alumni guest Melissa White. She'll talk about the blood, sweat, and tears of playing music, even now that she's made it. Learn more about Melissa's life in a professional quartet at fromthetop.org.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from U.S. Trust, believing that the arts have a worth all their own in stimulating the hearts and imaginations of our country's best young musicians. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Welcome back to the radio showcase for the best young classical musicians in the country, From the Top. We're celebrating our 10th anniversary year, this week from the Schwartz Center for Performing Arts at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Coming up, the Emory Youth Symphony Orchestra performs the stirring music of William Walton. From the Top's home is New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall in Boston, where talented young musicians are creating a new century of musical excellence. Today's show is made possible with support from the Coca-Cola Artist in Residence Program at Emory University. Special thanks this week to WABE and Georgia Public Broadcasting. Here again is Christopher O'Reilly.
This year, as we celebrate 10 years on the air, we're inviting some of our favorite performers from our early seasons back for a return visit so we can hear them play again and also find out where their lives have taken them since they were on our show. Today, a young woman who was with us during our second year on a show we taped at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. Please welcome the now 25-year-old violinist, Melissa White. Melissa, so great to be with you again, and might I say you don't look a day over 20.
Aw, thank you. You don't look a day over 21.
Aw. I'm sorry, what? I couldn't quite hear that. A little going deaf in my old age. Thanks very much, though. Very nice of you. You're a serious chamber music professional now, and we're going to hear about your life in one of the country's hottest young string quartets in a moment. But first, let's you and I play a little Brahms together.
Sounds good.
Tell our audience what we've chosen.
We are going to perform Brahms' D minor violin and piano sonata number 3, the last movement.
Thank you.
Alyssa White, 25 years old, our violinist, today's 10th anniversary alumni guest, now living in New York City, playing the finale of Brahms' D minor sonata. So great to play that with you. You've just blossomed into such a great musician. And you're still a wonderful soloist, Melissa, but one of the things we're thrilled about is you're doing so well as a professional in the Harlem String Quartet. A couple of weeks ago, we caught up with you on tour to learn more when the quartet was in residence at Rockport Music in Rockport, Massachusetts.
Okay, so I'm in this big quartet. We're called the Harlem Quartet, and we've been together now for about 3 years. We've gotten to know each other quite well, so it's sort of like I have three new older brothers.
My name's Desmond. I'm the cellist from the Harlem Quartet.
He keeps us grounded. He reminds us we actually only have 2 weeks to learn a piece, so we should maybe practice right now.
This is Miguel. I'm the violist of the quartet.
Miguel's our big personality, so if Miguel didn't sleep well, we all know it, and it might be a long day. If Miguel did sleep well, we also know that too, and he's going to be quite happy, and it's going to be quite an exciting day.
This is Ilmar. I play first violin in the Harlem Quartet.
As long as he's fed and he has good food and we don't rush him while we're eating meals, then he's gonna be just fine. We were mushed together by the Sphinx organization because we had been first prize winners of the Sphinx competition. They were interested in putting a group together who would help their mission of diversifying classical music. So we first get together in August of 2006.
Our first rehearsal was not very glamorous.
The music didn't sound good and people were taking it personally.
Right away I said, forget the idea of staying forever together, you know, of creating this Harlem Quartet.
Miguel and Desmond really butt heads and they actually got quite upset with each other, were really livid and were going to get into a fight. Things finally came together and we gave a successful performance at Carnegie Hall, which luckily gave us rave reviews in the New York Times. And so now we concertize year-round throughout the United States. One of the most rewarding parts of traveling is that we get to go into schools and play for students. My name is Melissa, and I play the
violin.
Very good. It's our job to show that it's fun and make students excited about classical music.
And the next piece we're going to play is a piece by Maurice Ravel.
Could we get everybody to say Maurice Ravel in their best French accent?
Maurice Ravel.
Ravel.
When you're playing in a quartet, every piece has a conflict in it. And the way we get around these conflicts is by not letting ourselves stew on the problem. So we have a couple rules. One of the rules is that everyone's idea must get tried, and it has to be tried more than once.
It's just that it never worked. There's not once we've done it where it's in tune.
Yeah.
And I think you can back off on your second act. You go...
Another rule we have is that if you've reached your level of patience, it's your responsibility to get up. So it's not productive if someone is sitting in rehearsal and is very upset inside and they just have a bad attitude towards what we're working on. Doesn't always work that lovely.
But maybe well, like before what we did was we
sounded like a suicide
crescendo.
Piano.
I know, that's not good.
Piano.
But, but those are our two foundational rules we try to work with. Being in a string quartet is a wonderful thing. I feel like it's the best of all worlds. So I get to be kind of soloistic at times. I get to do chamber music, and instead of traveling by myself when I go off to concertize, I have friends who come with me. So we have our ups and our downs, and we have lots of stories, but that's the thing, we have stories together, and it's not just me on the road. So it's been a lot of fun, and I feel really lucky.
It's a great piece.
So, Melissa, we heard you describing your quartet mates in their various personality quirks, but you left out the best part, yourself as sort of the self-described mother wolf of the group.
Kind of.
So since we've seen you, you've won the Sphinx competition, then you went to the highly competitive Curtis Institute, studying with Ida Kavafian and Jamie Laredo, and then got your master's at New England Conservatory, and now you're in the Harlem String Quartet. All this learning and success, and still with all that, you told me, well, I don't really know if I'm there as an artist. Is that something that you felt when you were in the middle of the Curtis Institute, or is that something you still feel today?
I guess I first noticed it when I went to the Curtis Institute of Music. It's such a small school, and you get there, and the talent is obviously so great, and the level is so high, and so entering as a freshman, I just saw all these seniors who were brilliant players, and I wondered if I would ever be able to be that good. So my years went by, and finally I was the senior, and I didn't quite feel how I was pretty sure they felt when I saw them be seniors, and I was like, this is weird. I wonder if I'll ever get it. And then I went off to do grad work, and I had a great teacher there who kind of helped me to still use all the rules I was taught, but to have more of a voice, more of a personality. And then now I got with the quartet, and even still, we each have a way that we think it should go, and we have a way we think it shouldn't go. So it's just a continuing learning process. And
always learning.
I guess I just have gotten used to that's how it'll be.
Moments of doubt, moments of inspiration. Yeah. But I can vouch for the fact that starting out, how many years ago? 8 years ago when we first played together, you were already just superstar quality back then, and it's only become greater and more burnished and beautiful, and it's such an honor and privilege to know you and to play with you again.
Aww,
Melissa.
Thank you.
And by the way, we've got a very cool video of you on our website at fromthetop.org, and there's also more there about the Harlem String Quartet, so you'll have to check that out as well. And really, all the best, Melissa. Great being with
you
again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back. Robin,
thanks. Melissa White, 25 years old, a member of the Harlem String Quartet, living now in New York City.
Podcasts of From the Top are available every week at fromthetop.org. Over the last 4 years, From the Top and the Jack Kent Cook Foundation have awarded over $1 million in scholarships to talented young musicians who have financial need. And we still have more to give. Go to fromthetop.org to learn more. Chris.
We have a really big finish today. Gathering behind me are the 99 members of the Emory Youth Symphony Orchestra with their conductor, Richard Pryor. These guys have a rousing, very British piece to play for us, but before they do, we're going to talk briefly with a couple of members of the orchestra. At the mics, we have Lisa Bianco, violin, and David Hoyt, viola. Both are 17 years old, and both are from here in Atlanta. You two, I'm shocked. This is outright child abuse. You were both damaged musically by your father's record collections. Lisa, is this true?
Sadly enough, yes. I grew up with classical CDs my entire life. We started out Beethoven, Grieg, Dvorak, everything, all the basics, a lot of Mozart, too. I remember my favorite birthday present was actually a CD set of all of Beethoven's 9 symphonies conducted by Sir George Solti.
Surprise, surprise, I guess. Dad knew how to do that. How do your musical tastes go over in school?
Actually, I took a technology class in 8th grade where we had to pretend we were a radio station and pick the songs that we were about to play. And now all my friends are like, oh, let's play Usher and Chris Brown. And I was like, Mozart, please. About something I know.
So did you actually get a little bit of Dvorak into the playlist?
We had rap and classical and then techno.
It was
sort of an
eclectic mix.
Yes.
This is good. We like to hear this. And David, you were damaged in a similar way?
I'm afraid so. My dad has a gigantic CD collection. It takes up an entire wall of his study. We don't really know how many CDs, but probably 3,000 or so. It's good because I never have to buy anything that we're playing. We usually have it already. But it's hard to even find anything because it's alphabetical, unless it's an opera and then it's on the top shelf or whatever.
And you were probably listening to the music before you were born. Your dad's been working on this collection for a while.
It's constantly going on in the house, so I can't escape.
Well, but how about, you're about to play some Walton, but you're a violist. Did he have a copy of the Walton Viola Concerto, for instance?
He didn't have that much viola repertoire, unfortunately, but I was able to convince him to order some more.
Schooled him in that regard. Yeah. Good for you. Very, very good. Let's bring Richard, your conductor, in on this discussion. Richard, have you thought about starting a support group for kids like this?
Well, it's occasionally crossed my mind, but having just listened to these two, I'm now pretty set on that idea.
Yes, so. It's a good idea. It's, actually, I think of them as quite lucky. You know, my first record that I ever bought was, this was back when they had wax cylinders instead of LPs, Toscanini doing the 1st and 9th Beethoven symphony. It was a very, very proud moment in my life. So I feel your pain. Well, we're anxiously awaiting this piece. Would you please introduce it?
Of course. We're going to be playing the Fugue from William Walton's Spitfire Prelude and Fugue. This was written in 1942 to celebrate the life of R.J. Mitchell in a film dedicated to that purpose. And it sort of explores the majesty of flight and the Spitfire fighter plane that was used during the Second World War.
Excellent. Great way to end our show today. And I want to thank all of our wonderful young performers. And thank you all for listening. This is Christopher O'Reilly. Please join me next week. And now, the Emory Youth Symphony Orchestra under Richard Pryor. You can take it from the top.
From the Top is written and produced by Tom Vagley for Tom Vagley Productions, with Tim Banker for From the Top. Musical direction by Tom Vinieri with Caroline Cardias-Menos. Our tour producer is David Balsam. Our production manager is Elizabeth DeVore. Technical direction by Barrett Willett with David Forbes and John Servies. Orchestra mix by Fred Horton. Additional audio production this week by Reed Mangan. The executive producers are Gerald Slavitt and Jennifer Hurley-Wales. I'm Joanne Robinson. From the Top is produced in association with WGBH Boston. Our home and educational partner is New England Conservatory in Boston.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.